Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to another FIA Group webinar. We're very pleased to have you today. Let me start by addressing the elephant in the room, or I should say actually the person who's not in the room, that being our own CEO, Adam Russo. Adam is actually trapped in the frozen South. As people who are talking to you live from the Boston metro area here in the Northeast, certainly a few feet of snow doesn't stop us. A few inches? Please. I'm wearing shorts and a t-shirt when I go out to clean that up, assuming I even think it's worth cleaning. Yet my understanding is that the iguanas are falling from the trees, the planes are falling off the runways, and our own Adam Russo is trapped in the balmy South. So, Adam, good luck getting home. We'll keep the seat warm for you. But as with these types of things, and as they say, there are two things that are certain in life, death and taxes. And with Adam or without, these taxes will roll on. So, again, welcome. A taxing time to tax those impact on self-insurance. For those of you who are dialed in thinking that we're going to tell you how to get the most out of your tax return, you know, maximize that refund, we are not H&R Block, and we are certainly not TurboTax. At least we don't do the turbo part. But we will talk about how this is going to impact our audience, our crowd, our client base, the self-funded benefit plans of America. There are three overarching goals I'd like to make sure we cover today. So write this down, and if we don't knock out all three, you can hold it against us. We'll refund the cost of the webinar. One is, what does the law actually do? A little background on the law, some of the specifics. Two, what's the impact on the self-funded benefit plan market? And three, what should we be on the lookout for? What kind of things can we potentially predict seeing coming down the road? And what kind of things can we do today to maximize the benefits and minimize the cost? These are your speakers today. You have myself, Ron Peck. I am the parsley on the side of the plate, and I am really just here to garnish the entrees of today's webinar. A generous helping of attorney Jen McCormick, vice president of our consulting team, attorney Brady Bizarro, who I am very pleased to tell you has been getting a lot more involved in compliance issues, not only on behalf of our clients, but on behalf of the FIA Group itself. Certainly the work that we do with our clients has taught us a lot of things. Brady in particular has done a lot of work on these topics for our clients, and in turn has taken a lot of what he's discovered working for our clients to help us as an employer, as a self-funded benefit plan sponsor, and vice versa, things that he has researched in order to assist us as an employer, we're then very happy to share with our clientele. So it has been a give and take, and Brady finds himself hopping on both sides of the fence, servicing the external client and internal client, and we're very, very lucky to have him here with us today. Speaking of lucky people, if you are subscribed to our LinkedIn page, you are very lucky to see some of the content that we post on a regular basis. But, you know, I am not an arrogant person. I am not going to pat myself on the back or tell you that I'm confident that what we're providing is so valuable you can't miss it. Ladies and gentlemen, the reason to subscribe to our LinkedIn page has less to do with seeing the material that we're posting and a lot more to do with what your colleagues, your contemporaries are writing in response. The comments and responses we get on a daily basis are incredible. They're valuable for those of you who are listening today who take the time to actually respond and share your opinion, not only with us, but with all the other subscribers. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And for those of you who are not subscribed, you're missing out on an opportunity to hear what your fellow members of this industry have to say about these interesting topics. So, Brady, moving on to the last little bit of self-promotion, I have to tell you how proud I am and how pleased I am with everybody who is involved in the work that goes into these webinars. You're very familiar, of course, with Adam, with myself, Ron Peck. You've got Brady Bizarro, Jen McCormick, John Jablon, an attorney at the FIA Group. He's constantly helping us put these slides together. Even though he doesn't really get to speak during these webinars all that often, he is an integral part of the webinar's production. Likewise, Christopher Aguiar, not always a member of the webinar discussion, but when we cover topics of claim recovery, subrogation, and the things that really form the foundation of this company, Chris is always quick to jump in and provide that information. And I gotta give huge credit to Matthew Payton, our social media coordinator. He's always behind the scenes. He's the one who's sending out those reminders. He's the one sending out the invitations. So thank you to them and everybody else involved in the creation of these webinars. As a result, we won an award, top-ranked webinar in healthcare for 2017, which, in case you're living under a stone, is actually a pretty hot topic. So congratulations to all involved. So very quickly, our agenda, as mentioned above, we're going to talk about the law, its impact, and some predictions. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to the man, the myth, the legend, Brady Bizarro. Brady?
Thanks, Ron. So yeah, as you could see from the outset, it's pretty ambitious of an agenda we have, a lot of things to get through. But this is it, right? This is the big deal everyone was waiting for, the big piece of legislation that passed in 2017. It was a tax bill, but in some ways, as you'll hear on this webinar, it was also a healthcare bill. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, we got a fancy little acronym to go with it, the TCJA. I'm sure that'll probably become something we use more and more going forward. President Trump signed it into law on December 22nd. There was a chance that he may have waited until the new year because of something called the PAYGO rules. I won't bore you with those details, but just know that he signed it into law and it's effective. But because it's effective now, there are still parts of it that don't take effect till 2019, and we'll be sure to point those out as we go along. So like Ron said, we're not H&R Block. We're not going to help you guys to, find all the loopholes and find a way to lower your tax liability as much as you possibly can. Instead, what we thought we'd do was give a breakdown of the major elements of the tax bill, focusing, of course, mostly on the impact to our industry, which stems from the elimination of the individual mandate. But basically, this tax bill was 30-plus years in the making. It's the brainchild of Paul Ryan, the House Speaker. It was really good for business. Obviously, you have permanent tax breaks for them. You have temporary tax breaks for individuals. And the reason for that is because of some fancy Senate rules that require, spending and the budget has to match up. They had to basically pay for this bill by making certain cuts temporary. We'll talk about those. We'll talk about the changes in the deduction. The personal exemption has been eliminated. A big deal, and you've heard a lot of this probably on the news, about the cap on the deductions you can take for state and local and property taxes. That's a big deal. They're curbing the impact of the dreaded alternative minimum tax, or the AMT, for individuals, and they're taking it out entirely for corporations. The estate tax has sort of been expanded, the amount you can exempt from tax. The healthcare reduction has been tinkered with slightly for a couple of years. We'll talk about that briefly as well. And the big, honcho here, the actual real bombshell and why this is effectively a healthcare bill, is that this eliminates the individual mandate. And as Jem will explain later on, it does not repeal the mandate. Legislatively, they cannot repeal.
Wait, what?
Right, yeah, surprise, right? It's still there, folks. It's still there. It's better to be careful with how you phrase this when you're talking, to your clients or among yourselves even. It's not that the legislation has been repealed. It's that it's really been zeroed out, the penalties. It's been eliminated. It's been axed. Use some other word. Just don't say repeal.
Declawed?
Declawed. That could work too.
Nice. I like that one.
So I put together some graphics here, and we're not going to go through each and every single one. Just know that Ron probably falls in the highest bracket in each case. Just keep that in mind as we go through this briefly.
Are these American dollars?
These are American dollars.
All right, then the answer is no, but thank you for that.
So as you'll see here, there is tax relief here, right? It's on a temporary basis, again, for individuals, but basically you're going to see some reduction in the amount you pay in general. And so I won't read all of them, but a couple big things to take note of is the point of this tax bill is Trump said originally he wanted you to be able to file your taxes on a note card, right? You don't have to work with a H&R Block company or TurboTax. The reason for that is because he's incentivizing people to no longer itemize their deductions. So that's why they're doubling the standard deduction. They're making it, less likely that you're going to say, all right, well, let's go through and line by line, fill out 25 pages of deductions. Instead, you're more likely to just use the standard deduction. That could be a good thing for simplicity. And, it's pretty substantial, right? Now, instead of $6,300, $12,000 for singles, $24,000 for married couples filing jointly, kind of a big deal. But take note that the exemption being eliminated here, $4,000, is kind of cutting into the any impact you may have or any benefit you may have in the doubling of the deduction. So keep note of that. The state local property tax thing, that's a big deal, especially in coastal states like our own, where you have high property values. People are complaining about that, and there's some creative ways that states are reacting to that, a bit beyond the scope, again, of what we're here to discuss. But a lot of details and things are changing. And so I wanted to just give a slide that you guys can use to see that sort of all in one place. So by the numbers, what are we talking about here for businesses? A big reduction in the corporate tax rate, reduced from 35% to 21%. So this is going to be a good thing for, you know, employers generally and for our industry in particular. And the reason for that is the second bullet point there, where we talk about pass-through taxes. Very complicated subject. We're not going to get too much into detail on it. But just know that if you're organized in such a way that you are paying taxes as a pass-through entity, you may be eligible for a 20% deduction, after which a lower rate is applied to you, which is lower than the higher individual rate. The exception there is that there are some limitations and restrictions based on certain specified services, trades, or businesses. And guess who's included in those? Healthcare is there. Lawyers are there. Accountants are there. Professionals are there. So in other words, there you'll get some benefit to that, but there is a phase-in where the benefit decreases. Keep that in mind. It's more detailed than I want to go into. But the bottom line is the impact on our industry is going to be a good thing, because the truth is many Fortune 500 companies have been paying far less than the corporate tax rate of 35%. You remember a few years ago, GE was announced to have paid effectively zero taxes in 1 year because of loopholes and special breaks. Many people in our industry, many of the clients we work with are parts of businesses that do not qualify for those special breaks and special loopholes. So they probably were paying closer to 35% than the bigger companies were. So they're going to take more advantage of this the corporate tax cut from 35 to 21% perhaps than a larger company would. So you're going to feel more of the impact there. And in either case, if you're organized as an LLC or a partnership or some other business entity other than a C corp, you're going to feel some benefit from this, despite the restrictions and limitations we talked about on the previous slide. So employers and TPAs in our industry will have more money to invest, to hire, to buy supplies, to build up their IT infrastructure. You're going to have more money to do it. But of course, what we're here to talk about primarily is the individual mandate and what happened to it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jen to talk about why we even are in this situation. Jen?
All right. Thank you. So now that we all know exactly what has happened with this new tax bill, let's talk about how this is going to potentially impact us and why everyone is talking about the individual mandate. Why does it matter? Where employers, we're working with companies that are providing employer-based coverage. So why does the individual mandate have any impact on us? And even more than that, why was this even the target in the first place? So one of the original goals that the Republicans came up with was to repeal an unpopular tax and improve and offer tax relief to the middle class. I don't think that it's a surprise to anybody that even President Obama wasn't as excited about offering the requirement to punish people for having insurance or if they didn't have insurance. That was not necessarily part of how President Obama had campaigned for how he wanted to change Obamacare. And even in Massachusetts, that wasn't necessarily part of the original idea with Mitt Romney's plan here. So it's not a surprise to anybody that this is an easy target, because this was not necessarily the most popular part of ACA. But according to Trump, President Trump, when the individual mandate is being repealed, that means Obamacare is being repealed, because they get their money from the individual mandate. Obamacare has been repealed with this bill.
Wow, that's big news.
That's big news. That's news to me. So unfortunately, that is not the truth. As Brady had mentioned, the individual mandate has not been repealed. It's important to note that this still exists. So what we'll talk about in the next couple of slides is that although the penalty has been reduced to zero, there still is the technical requirement that the individual has to retain coverage. So just because you are not being penalized for not having it doesn't mean that you're not required to do that. So there has been the estimate that by eliminating the individual mandate, it's going to free up $338 billion over 10 years. However, according to the CBO, there has been a note that that's not necessarily going to be how much is going to be saved. Because of the technical requirement to still retain coverage, it's not necessarily that you're getting penalized for it. We still think there's going to be the opportunity for people to still have coverage, have individual coverage, even if they're not necessarily being penalized to have it. And even more than that, the individual mandate is one piece of the Affordable Care Act. There are many other pieces of the Affordable Care Act that are still in effect and that have not necessarily been changed. So, for example, there still are exchanges. Employers are still required to provide health insurance. There are still requirements to offer preventive care. There have been a lot of changes that have impacted the growth of coverage for individuals. For example, Medicaid expansion has been a really big deal. And that really has been how a lot of individuals have actually received expanded access to coverage. So is the individual mandate as big of a deal as we think it's going to be? Let's talk about how we got there. Okay, so there was a Supreme Court case, and I actually remember this very well, a little bit of a background. I was actually in Mexico, and it was back in 2013 or 2011, when I was on my bachelorette party, it was a good time, and everyone is sitting by the pool having cocktails, and I'm on my iPad trying to figure out what is going to happen with the employer mandate? What is going to happen with ACA? What is the impact of everything that I have spent and read all 2,094 pages of this bill? What is going to happen? What is going to result? I was anxiously waiting, not drinking, because I wanted to know exactly what was going to happen. And this was a really important case for me. This was a big deal. And ultimately, it was upheld. That's not a surprise to anybody. But what happened in this case, it was a 5-4 decision, and the Supreme Court justice was actually the one that made the decision that this was actually a tax and not necessarily a requirement to put coverage on people. So there's a lot of debate about the impact of what the rule for individual insurance was going to do. There was problems about whether or not this is actually infringing on an individual's right to obtain health insurance. And the result was they held this to be a tax. And this goes back to looking at this particular section of ACA, where it specifically says, an applicable individual shall for each month beginning after 2013 ensure that the individual and any dependent of the individual who is an applicable individual is covered under minimum essential coverage for the month. So there are a lot of terms in there that are going to be important to remember. And right now, it outlines what the penalties are going to be. So everything revolves around this being a potential tax. And why this case actually is important for us, because when they were making the decision in this case, all of the opinions, all 9 opinions, decided that the ability to provide this as a tax, the individual mandate itself, was crucial to ACA, was essential to ACA in their opinion. So without this being a tax, then they potentially had doubts about how integral and how essential ACA would actually hold up without having an individual mandate as part of the entire bill. But we'll actually break that down in a little bit, and I know that Brady is dying to talk about the death spiral.
I am. So thanks, Jen. So one thing to note here is you'll recall that there was a lot of angst given to the Chief Justice Roberts, who essentially, quote unquote, saved Obamacare. And Jen said that the individual mandate was seen as crucial to Obamacare. Well, why is that? Well, many reasons, but essentially it is the glue holding Obamacare together. It solves a couple of problems. So if you can step back for a second and remember that one of the points of the Affordable Care Act to begin with was to address the problem of unaffordable coverage for certain individuals. That was done by what's called the guaranteed issue and community rating provisions. So together, basically what those provisions did was it required insurance companies to treat people alike despite their health status and to not charge people with pre-existing conditions more money than those who didn't have them. So you're forcing insurance companies to cover people and you're not allowing them to differentiate among people with different health statuses, more expensive health statuses. So the result of that is that you can create a problem which is known in the policy world as adverse selection, or basically a person who is sick will wait until they get sick to get coverage. And over time, what you'll get in the market is you'll have a market full of people who have all waited until they got sick and have very expensive conditions and then wanted to get covered. And then that problem is exacerbated by the fact that insurance companies are required to cover them and can't charge them more. So the Supreme Court understood in its case that without the individual mandate, you can't solve this problem. And in fact, in the decision, they refer to Massachusetts as saying that state has cracked the adverse selection problem. We cracked it by having an individual mandate, because if you're forcing these young, typically young, healthy people to buy insurance, then you're not going to have risk pools that are just full of sick elderly people who are costing too much money. And so getting rid of that requirement, the mandate, is going to potentially lead to the problem of adverse selection, which over time, if left unresolved, becomes what's called the death spiral, where insurance companies start raising rates by exorbitant amounts, people lose more coverage because they can't afford the rates, and then insurers start pulling out of the market, and literally the market itself collapses over time. And that's something that's very real. The other problem, of course, is the problem of free riders, which is just, you know, why is it fair for people to wait until they get sick and then all of a sudden go to the ER and want to get uncompensated care, which is then passed on to everyone else. So it really is the glue here. It's very, very important. And the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has made a few projections that by ending the individual mandate, about 13 million fewer people will be insured by 2027. That's people individual on individual plans. So that's a lot of people, obviously. And they also predict, or project rather, that premiums in the marketplaces will rise by at least 10% in 2019. And if you've listened to either the news or any of our previous webinars in the past few months, you'll know that that's on top of the increases of 100% or in certain states, 150%. So, I mean, it's getting untenable as we go forward. So it's a big deal. It's very important. But we want to make sure we get this right about what the tax bill does and does not do with respect to the individual mandate and its effects. So for that, I'll turn it over to Jen.
Okay. So what does the bill do? So it does reduce the penalty to zero in 2019. Remember, this is not necessarily, this is not in effect for 2018. This is for 2019. So you have a year to go. Well, just under a year to go. This does still technically require that individuals comply with the individual mandate. It's just that you are not going to be penalized via a tax if you don't have coverage. So there's no penalty in 2019, but you're still technically required to have it. I think that's an important distinction to remember, is that that potential technicality is going to be one of the reasons why individuals still may want to have coverage, because they're still required to have it. What doesn't this bill do? So while it does impact the individual market makes about 7% of all those who are insured. Keep that in mind, the 7% number, which isn't necessarily a large number. The other important thing that this bill does not do is it does not appeal or repeal all of ACA. It does not appeal the or repeal the employer mandate that is still in effect. There are a lot of pieces of ACA that are still relevant for us to talk about. Remember, that still exists. So as we are putting together our plans, if we haven't already, for 2018 and beyond, and all of our options and cost containment strategies, now it's going to be crucial to make sure that you have coverage that's going to be attractive not only to your current population, but to potentially the individuals who may not have coverage or want coverage. What is it that you can do with your plan design that would make it a more attractive option? So taking a look at all of the benefits that exist currently for that potentially healthy and young market that Brady was talking about, what type of benefits might be attractive to them? Start to think about that. Start to put that together as you're looking at your plans, because as of right now, nothing has been done to the employer mandate. We'll talk about that a little bit later. So one of the reasons why the mandate didn't actually get repealed itself is because this is a tax bill. This is not a bill where it was able to actually impact the legislation itself, just the tax consequences of it. We didn't have 60 votes in order to, or there weren't 60 votes that were available in order to actually repeal the bill itself. The other thing I think it's important is to do a little bit of fact checking about the individual mandate. So in 2016, there were about 6.5 million households who paid $3 billion in penalties. And the CBO reported that in 2017, the cost for providing ACA was $120 billion. And the cost of those penalties was about 3%. I checked the math on that. So the individual mandate, the point that I'm trying to make is the individual mandate itself does not fund ACA. This in and of itself is not going to be the only thing that is going to keep ACA afloat as it exists today. So what does that mean for this particular section of ACA that still exists when we're talking about the offer of coverage, that little reference to the section in ACA that I read before? There are certain terms within that provision that are still going to be important for us today. So since the bill or since the law still is in effect, it's just the penalty that doesn't matter. These terms still matter. These terms are still intact and have not changed. For example, the definition of minimum essential coverage, an eligible employer-sponsored plan, modified adjusted gross income, those are relevant for us today, for us to determine, in particular with our self-funded plans, is the plan that we are offering meeting the requirements for minimum essential coverage? Do I offer an eligible employer-sponsored plan? So just because there is no tax that's going to be applied for an individual doesn't mean that these terms still aren't going to be relevant. So keep that in mind, that just because there's no tax, you still have to review the actual reference to the law for the individual mandate because it's going to be meaningful. All right, what else did it not do? So there are other parts of ACA besides taxes and penalties. There are reporting requirements. Our favorite of these reporting requirements is Section 6055 of the IRC. And in particular, that section of the code requires that anyone who provides minimum essential coverage, that term that has not been changed, that has not been modified, that is still intact, which means any insurer, any employer, any government program, anyone that is offering what is considered to be MEC coverage, minimum essential coverage, they still must file their tax forms. That's a big deal. This is potentially a, I don't want to say onerous requirement, but this is an obligation, and this still exists. This reporting requirement still must be done by any of those entities that are providing what is going to be considered minimum essential coverage. And there's also the possibility here, too, that there are applications for deciding who or who may not actually be exempt from meeting the requirements of providing or offering or receiving minimum essential coverage. And none of those application procedures, those reporting requirements, none of those have been touched. So I anticipate that there's going to be a lot of confusion about what needs to get done and how it's going to need to get done. The last thing that this bill did not do was eliminate the employer mandate or its reporting requirements or any of its penalties, obviously. So we all know what the employer mandate is and what it means for employers, because this is one of the reasons why employers have had to actually make changes and modifications to their plans that they're offering to make sure that they are offering it to any individual who works the 30 hours per week, making sure that the coverage itself is affordable and meets the minimum value requirements. As of right now, none of those requirements, none of those obligations have changed. So it's important to don't think about this as the opportunity for doomsday of what this will mean and how the employer mandate is going away. You still are required to comply with this. And in fact, there have been lots of businesses who have received these bills to pay these taxes and pay these penalties because they haven't necessarily been complying and people have been getting these subsidies. So the impact to employer insurance and to self-insurance is that you are still required to offer a self-funded plan. It's yet to be seen how many individuals will or will not continue to have coverage individually, and or maybe some of these other regulations, the Association Health Plan Bill, some of the state action that's being taken. Will these individuals be looking elsewhere to provide coverage that maybe is too affordable to get on or unaffordable to get on the exchanges? This should be potentially an opportunity to revisit our self-funded plans and find ways to attract people that we previously hadn't attracted in the past.
And I added a slide in here that I'm going to get back to Jim before we hand over to Ron, just because an important piece of this tax bill included a tax credit for the paid family medical leave. So I wanted to give Jim the chance to talk about that.
Yeah, this is, I'll try not to go on and on about this, but this is important. So when I first heard about this and all the discussions that people had been talking surrounding why this had gone into the law and why this was meaningful, I was excited. I thought this was an opportunity for a business to get credit for offering paid leave while an individual was out on FMLA. But there are a lot of nuances and conditions and elements of this that make it maybe not necessarily as useful as I originally thought that it was going to be. So I'll break it down a little bit. So what happens here under the tax bill is that certain employers can get a business credit. That's great. Equal to the percentage of wages that have been paid to certain employees who are out on FMLA. But in order to get this credit, those particular employers must have offered at least 2 weeks of leave and paid their employees 50% of their regular wages. So you can see that the credit is between 12.5% to 25%, and that varies based between 50% and 100% of how much the employer actually pays while the individual employee is out on leave. I know that's confusing, so you can call me afterwards and I'll help you with the math. So the point here is that you have to be out on leave. The employee can't make more than $72,000 per year, and the employer has to have a particular written policy in place. And the key is that this time cannot be provided as vacation, PTO, medical, or sick leave, and has to be this separate, different policy. So while many employers are already getting excited, this is a new opportunity for me, I already provide this, a lot of the policies that already exist include vacation and PTO time as part of their FMLA paid leave policy. So this has to be something that's completely separate. So it's very possible that a lot of these policies that exist currently are not going to be eligible for this particular tax credit. The other thing to keep in mind for this bill that I read was that this applies for people who are out on FMLA. Not every employer is subject to FMLA. There are certain requirements for an eligible employer. So how would the leave be handled? How would the credit be handled if you're offering a paid leave as an employer who is not required to provide FMLA? Also, this credit does not apply in situations where a state requires or mandates that paid leave is already required, like New York, for example. So this really is carving out an opportunity for some other states that don't necessarily have these policies in place, but the threshold and the eligibility requirements for those that actually can take advantage of this seem to be smaller and smaller the more that I read into the bill. But I don't think that it should be overlooked. I think it's definitely a possibility that could be important for an employer who's looking to take care of their young and healthy population. Because remember, a lot of people who are potentially not going to have insurance are young, healthy individuals. They are going to feel like they're young, they're invincible, they're not required to have it. Maybe those are the same type of people who are in the child-rearing stages, and potentially FMLA could be an important benefit to them. So this might be another way that you could tie this into the health plan and offer an important benefit, and then as an employer, get a credit that you might not otherwise have had opportunity to get.
And so it raises a lot of questions. And for the answers, of course, as always, we turn to indomitable Ron Peck.
Yeah, sure. I think I may pull a Confucius on everybody and just answer questions with questions. Before we continue, I do want to stop and rewind a little bit. At what point, Jen McCormick, you referred to IRC section 6055 as our favorite section, and I don't want you to speak for me. I've always considered myself more of a section 6054 guy myself,
all right.
But, you know, actually, I have no idea. It's probably a definition section for all I know. So let's stop and take a step back. First and foremost, yes, there is a lot of information here. It's a very complicated discussion. We're only scratching the surface, and it feels complicated. So for those of you who are wondering and feverishly taking notes, not only will the slides either be made available to you, or I believe they've actually already been sent to the registrants, and they will be available on our website, but a recorded version of the webinar will be made available as soon as possible as well. So for those of you who are trying to pay attention to what's being said, but also trying to pay attention to what's on the screen, good news. Don't worry about what's on the screen. Focus on me. We all pretty much universally agree that the immediate impact is going to be on the individual market. Okay, we get that. I recently saw a video online about how they reintroduced wolves into this natural preserve. And because it reduced the population of deer, that increased the amount of plants. The plants resulted in other wildlife coming back in. And by the time it's over, the rivers have changed their direction. I mean, it's insane how one little thing can trickle down. And we've used that terminology here as well, trickle down, throughout the presentation. Because while we agree, like the wolves, the immediate impact is on the deer, there are additional impacts elsewhere. If you are someone with whom we've worked in the past or you're a member of our industry, chances are your biggest concern is the group benefit plan market, that industry, the employer-based health benefits. And so you're probably thinking, okay, I understand this individual market, individual policy impact. How is it going to impact the group market? And for us, I think there's two things we need to look at, right? The first is how does the law directly impact the employer group benefit market? And the second is how is the impact on the individual market going to trickle down and impact the employer group market? So, of course, my initial reaction is to think, oh boy, the sky is falling. It's the glasses half empty view. And before I continue, you know, one of our audience members at one point expressed concern regarding the way the CBO is referencing the fact that people are losing coverage. And this particular audience member complains, you know, aren't these people voluntarily dropping coverage without the mandate forcing them to purchase insurance? They're leaving it on purpose. The way the CBO makes it sound, they're like they're victims, when the truth is they were currently victims because they were being forced to purchase something they didn't want. I think one of the justices referred to being forced to buy broccoli. Wasn't that it?
Yeah.
You should eat broccoli. It's good for you. Anyway, but, you know, and I agree to a certain degree. But at the same time, I do foresee the potential for people losing coverage, being priced out. So look at it this way. If I'm a carrier, I have these individual fully funded traditional policies on the market, the people that I'm banking on to purchase these policies, and, you know, I just want to say right now, having just gone through a birthday, I'm starting to get sensitive to our use of the terminology young and healthy. So I'm going to, from this point on, start referring to people as the low-risk lives and high-risk lives, as if you haven't had enough acronyms, LRLs and HRLs.
Oh,
that's a mouthful. But anyway, you know, you're banking on these low-risk lives to come in and essentially bolster your risk pool so that you can bear the cost of these high-risk lives. Once they start leaving, what are you going to do? Well, you have to shift the cost. So let's say, hypothetically, I'm a large carrier. The knee-jerk reaction is to raise the rates for the fully insured traditional group policyholders. Well, an employer may see this increase in premium in cost and say, well, I can't afford this anymore. So if I'm an employee of this employer and I'm banking on this employer providing me with access to health insurance and now they can't afford health insurance anymore, I may be losing coverage not because I chose to drop it, but because we were priced out by the carrier who in turn was impacted by this law. So you could see how people losing this may not only be those low-risk lives, but also people who need the insurance and can no longer afford it. So again, that knee-jerk reaction, well, if they don't have to buy it, they won't buy it. It's true, but I think it has a trickle-down effect as well. So again, I understand where you're coming from when you look at how this is potentially going to impact us. But additionally, when you look at the low-risk lives, which really is what we're talking about how do we keep these risk pools well-funded? Because it's those low-risk lives that ultimately pay for the high-risk lives. How do we do it? How do we keep people on the plan? And we're working under an assumption, or I should say a couple assumptions. The first assumption that I think everybody's working under is that all low-risk lives are the same. That I could have two low-risk lives working for me, and both of those people, the moment they hear they don't have to have insurance anymore, are going to say, sweet, party time. That's not necessarily true. And if you look historically in the past, when health benefits, health insurance wasn't mandated, people still sought it out. And we'll talk a little bit about that on the next slide. But there are people who are low-risk lives who still see the value in health insurance. They still understand that, yeah, I don't have an ongoing chronic disease. I don't need insurance to pay my day in, day out maintenance. But I know, either from my own experience from friends or research, that if I break my leg on the slopes because I'm an active skier, right? If I don't have insurance, that could bankrupt me. So again, getting people to understand that insurance is not necessarily there to pay foreseeable expected cost, but rather is there to protect you against unforeseeable costs that you can't afford to take. Because again, insurance ultimately is about shifting risk. A lot of low-risk lives will still see the value in purchasing insurance, but only, again, if we can offer them through a cost-benefit analysis something that's worthwhile. So as far as the individual traditional fully insured market is concerned, I think they're going to price themselves out of the market. I think this is going to be the death knell for them, and I'm very curious to see how they recover. Furthermore, the trickle down to the fully insured traditional group market, I think those rates are going to continue to increase, and there's not enough innovation and ability to customize those policies to react to this quick enough. So I do see it potentially impacting them very negatively. So ultimately, it comes down to the fully insured market. How do we react? The self-funded market, rather. How do we react to stop the loss, stop the bleeding? And my concern, not only is the low-risk lives that leave our plans, our self-funded plans, but if these carriers are taking it on the chin, will carrier ASOs pass some of that cost on to their self-funded plans? Will networks that are affiliated with these large carriers increase their fees? Will stop-loss carriers who are affiliated or TPAs that are affiliated with these carriers potentially have to increase their fees? So you could see how this trickle-down effect could even impact self-funded plans. So be prepared for that. Last but not least, if large carriers are being negatively impacted by this new rule and they're losing lives, will they potentially squeeze providers so that these providers turn around and have demands or increase the rates they charge against self-funded plans who have absolutely no affiliation with these large carriers? So I know I'm trying to be positive, and at the same time I'm scaring everybody here, but these are different ways that you could potentially see the impact on the carriers impacting individual self-funded plans that otherwise have nothing to do with them. So I promise to be positive, optimistic. Let's talk about the glass half full. Again, I think we underestimate low-risk lives. The FIA group, ourselves, I feel very fortunate to work with a very large professional staff that is generally more or less a young staff, young professionals. And when we tell them about our health plan, our self-funded plan, the things that we're doing, the cost that we're saving them, the benefits we're offering them, they are genuinely engaged and excited. And I truly believe that even if I tell my staff right now, hey guys, you're not required to have health insurance anymore, you can go ahead and drop the plan, very few, if any, of our employees are going to drop the plan, because they know that they are getting value for the dollars that they spend on the plan. And as a result, these low-risk lives are there to buffer our risk pool and sustain the higher-risk lives that are here. Because by the grace of God, one of those low-risk lives could become a high-risk life, and they understand that. They understand that. So, again, I referenced before, prior to the individual mandate, why did people purchase insurance if they weren't required to do so? I understand in my conversations with everybody who's listening right now that things have changed. Costs of insurance have gone up. The requirements under the ACA for the plan, you can't offer these bare bones plans anymore. Even the most basic plan is still pretty robust compared to the most basic plan of the past. The actual cost of healthcare has gone up. You know, an appendectomy, you can't get an appendectomy these days for what you used to get it, right, 10, 20 years ago. Those were the days, right? Just cut, slice, dice. So I understand that we can't just fall back to what we were doing pre-ACA and hope that we can offer a plan that's cheap enough to attract these low-risk lives. So instead of trying to just bargain basement the plan, instead, let's create value. And what you'll learn is that value doesn't necessarily mean cheap. Value means you get a lot for your money. That's the big difference. And hopefully the conversation we're having now will get you to start thinking about that and hopefully continue the conversation after this presentation so that we could talk about things you can do with your plan so that your staff and your low-risk lives will view your plan the way our staff and our low-risk lives view our plan. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Brady to talk a little bit more about the mandate.
Thanks, Ron. So one thing to note here, this I just want to note another consequence of the individual mandate's elimination, and that is that inadvertently, this may actually lead some employers to escape the effects of the employer mandate. And so you might ask, how could that be? Well, recall that there are effectively two employer mandates, right? There's one on employers who fail to offer minimum essential coverage to their full-time employees if any of those employees receive the premium tax credits and are enrolled through an exchange program, because that's federal dollars, and that's a penalty if they do that. The other one is a larger penalty for employers who just simply fail to offer minimum essential coverage. Who do offer minimum essential coverage but fail to offer minimum value coverage. Both of these mandates are tied to individuals who are, because of the violations by the employer, are shopping on the exchanges and are receiving federal subsidies. But the point to pick up on here is that if the individual mandate is gone, it's likely that many of these people won't actually seek coverage on the exchange. Maybe they make too much to even qualify for a tax subsidy. Maybe they feel it's not worth it, or they just don't care about healthcare. It's unlikely, but an unintended consequence is that some employers may not be penalized for those employees who otherwise lose coverage under their employer plan, but nevertheless don't seek coverage elsewhere on the exchanges. But know that the reporting requirements, as Jen mentioned before, as also being the case for the individual mandate, they still remain effective. That said, there are some recent developments as recently as a couple of days ago with regard to the employer mandate, and I'll let Jen explain those just briefly.
Is the employer mandate next?
Ooh, drastic.
That is the question. So trying to figure out the details. We don't have any idea what the actual impact is going to be on how the individual mandate will actually, in numbers, with math, impact us, the self-funded industry. Now there's discussion about suspending the employer mandate and canceling these penalties from 2015 to 2018. It's possible that they're arguing that this is bad for employers, that the Affordable Care Act, as it's written, puts on extensive requirements and obligations for employers, and that they have reporting requirements they have to comply with, that coverage must meet certain specifications. In addition to offering a plan, they also have to craft an SBC and offer it every year. And anytime there's a modification that they change their SBC, and there are so many requirements that it's making offering coverage as an employer more difficult. But as Ron mentioned, prior to Obamacare, prior to ACA, employers offered health insurance. Shocking, right? We have to remember that there still was a reason to offer health benefits. It is an employee benefit. And particularly one of the things here that Ron was talking about too, that we use to attract our talent and to retain our talent here, we find that offering a benefit plan is an important and significant benefit, and to get that engagement is going to be relevant. So I don't think that we necessarily need to lose sight of that. And even more than that, the cost of eliminating the employer mandate could be very significant for the federal government. Brady was talking about the two different penalties that could potentially apply as a result of the employer mandate, the tack hammer and the sledgehammer penalties. So underneath the structure of how subsidies are set up and tax credits are set up right now, even if there's no requirement in 2019 for an individual to be penalized for not having coverage, even though there's technically still a requirement, it's possible that people could still apply for and become eligible for a subsidy, for a tax credit. And one of the ways that you are not eligible for a tax credit is if your employer offers a plan that otherwise meets the requirements, whether it's the tax A or it's the tax B. So if there is no employer mandate, there is nothing that is going to be saving these individuals, as Ron has been discussing, that are still going to find value in offering and having health insurance, that are going to get these tax credits. That is a potentially high and substantial cost to the federal government if the employer mandate is eliminated. By having the employer mandate, it is saving some people from getting those tax credits, from getting it on their own individual employer plan. So what's next? What's going to happen, Brady?
So if you couldn't tell where Jen was going with this, it's that states are not sitting by idly and waiting things to happen. And personally, this is my favorite part of this presentation because as a policy nerd, I love it when there's sort of a tick for tack, right? There's one move by the federal government, and there's a state response, and it's a cat and mouse game going on. And we have that exact situation going on here, because what would you expect states to do who are finding more and more enrollees on their Medicaid programs and the budgets are exploding? Here in Massachusetts, we have that exact problem. We went from having 1 in 5 people on our mass health program to 1 in 3 people on the mass health program, and it's consuming the state budget. And so the states aren't going to let these coverage mandates go very easily. Why? We talk about the cost. Another reason is that states want to show that they have low uninsured rates, right? We're very proud of only having 2.8% people not covered in our state. Vermont, 3.8%. That's a very low number. Iowa, 5%. Governors like to be able to say, look, we have almost universal coverage in our state. That's one reason, too. And I mentioned Massachusetts has 41% of our budget consumed by Medicaid. And Texas, their program costs 33% of their budget. And, if you've been paying attention to the news lately, you know that the economy is doing relatively well. Hiring is up. Unemployment is low. The stock market is at record high. So you would expect that more people would be getting employer insurance. That's not happening in many cases in many states, because what you have is employers who are either cutting hours for their employees or just offloading them in other ways, and those employers are finding themselves either being paid so low that they qualify for state programs, and it's just unsustainable. So we have some responses. And one state, Massachusetts, of course, already had an individual mandate in place and an employer mandate in place prior to the ACA. And so people are following the lead of our state and proposing their own responses. And I want to mention there's a couple that in the recent weeks have announced their intentions. One of them is Maryland, and they have a very interesting proposal here. It's very creative. So in our state, Massachusetts, if you don't have health coverage, the state will assess the tax on you on top of the federal tax, and you'll pay a penalty for that. Maryland, what they've done is they've say, all right, we're going to have a penalty that you pay, but you can take that penalty and apply it as a down payment on a health insurance plan. That's pretty creative. So it sends a signal there that, hey, look, they're not just, you know, this is not just Taxachusetts. We're not just raising money for the sake of it. We want you to get health coverage. You can take this $700 or so, whatever it may be, penalty and use it to buy coverage for yourself. I think that's very creative. I think other states will look at that and say, interesting. D.C. also is having this problem. There's some rumblings in California and New Jersey because, again, the adverse selection problem is ubiquitous. It applies across the, you know, individual market, the employer market. And, again, the state and federal government will find themselves paying more money if they don't react to these problems. So a little more detail about how this may impact replacement of the employer mandate. And I want to just give a quick rundown of what Massachusetts has done this year, which effectively has reintroduced what I like to call a backdoor employer mandate. So obviously when the ACA was put into place and the employer mandate was made effective, our state repealed its employer mandate. You don't need to have two, right? We already have the federal government one. So, but what they found happened because of the expanding mass health roles, the governor wanted to find a way to incentivize employers to offer coverage to their employees, even those who have cut hours or who pay their employees so little that they qualify for mass health. And one of the things they've done to fix this problem is to impose essentially a tax. It's called the EMAC supplemental tax. But basically it applies whether or not any employer in our state even has to offer coverage. It applies to full-time employees, to part-time employees. The bottom line is any employee in Massachusetts who qualifies for the mass health program or for the state's exchange through which is paid for by the state and by the federal government, you will have to pay as an employer a tax on that employee every single year. And it's a pretty hefty tax. And so the thinking behind that is that you'll raise money to sort of offset the increase in the roles of the mass health program. I think you're going to see other states look at this and say, all right, even if the employer mandate is eliminated, which looks like it may happen this year, given the GOP's position, you're going to have states that react, and employers are probably going to find themselves still subject to some version of an employer mandate, whether that be through a legislative policy proposal or through some kind of creative backdoor tax. And so we'll be watching those as we go forward to see what those states develop and how they react. A couple other states that have some interesting proposals that they've shopped around, I want to mention quickly. One of them is Colorado. They have a ballot measure under consideration for November of this year, which would essentially force hospitals and providers to disclose some very important information that we would love to see in our industry, namely the charge masters, right? What is the master list of what everything costs at the hospital? What are they charging for your hip replacement, your knee replacement? Whether charges can be negotiated, big deal. Know that up front. So that'll give you a big leg up. And finally, which insurance plans they will accept. I'm not sure if this actually is going to pass in Colorado, but it would be a big deal. And I think other states will look at this, that move and perhaps try to copy it. Idaho, also recently, the governor there issued an executive order on fully insured plans, which basically instructs the state DOI to ignore parts of the ACA. I doubt this is going to survive legal scrutiny, and we're going to talk more about in our next webinar about association health plans and sort of the signals that we're getting from the administration about which plans can be offered and which parts of the ACA, such as the essential health benefit requirements, can be waived or can be loosened as they apply to our industry. So we'll have more to say on those proposals in the next webinar. But I think the important point to take away from all this is that states are not going to sit back and just let these mandates be repealed, that it's going to cost them more money and they're going to react in some way, either through a policy proposal, through a bill, through a tax. We should expect to see that going forward. And so as they do that, we'll be on top of it, and we'll let you know what comes of it.
So as we enter the final stretch here, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the questions that I'm seeing here really make me realize that while it sometimes feels like we're in a very sort of cut and dry, mathematical, political industry, the truth is there's a lot of psychology and sociology and things like that involved here as well. You know, for instance, one person asks the question, how do you think this is going to impact the NEC plans, right? So these quote-unquote skinny plans. And And it's interesting because on the one hand, I could think, well, who's purchasing these MEC plans? People who don't really want to pay for insurance. So what do? They buy the cheapest version they can get while remaining legal, and there you go. But now that you're telling that audience, hey, the cheapest plan you could buy now is no plan. Oh, well, then nobody needs the MEC plan anymore, right? So people who need insurance are buying the robust plan, and the people who used to buy MEC plans don't buy any insurance at all. Goodbye, MEC plan. But at the same time, I don't know, maybe these low-risk lives are thinking, well, gosh, you know, I'd like to have something in case something happens. I don't need a robust plan. I know I don't have to have insurance, but this insurance is so cheap. Why wouldn't I just keep it? So it's amazing. It really is that psychology, the psychology of the low-risk life. So that's one thing that I think is fascinating. You know, we have other people here who are industry people who are involved in the individual market who can tell us right now, you know, that they're already seeing a drop in numbers amongst the people who are purchasing these fully insured traditional insurance individual policies on the exchanges. And they already see how that's trickling down and hurting the carriers who are offering these policies. And what are these carriers going to do to make up this money? They're already seeing it now. So just imagine over the next year into 2019 what that's going to do. And the question then is, if these low-risk lives are dropping these individual policies, who are these people? Who are these people who were purchasing policies in the past and are not purchasing them now? And are those people who we, as the group health benefit industry, the self-funded industry, employers and administrators, are these people we want to scoop up and add to our plans? And what do we need to do in order to do that? Because if they were already holding individual policies, obviously we failed already because they didn't join our plans in the past. So what can we do differently now that we didn't do years ago to keep those people on our plans and off the individual marketplace? That's my challenge to you. And with that in mind, let me tell you quickly, our next webinar will address actual plan creation, the structure of the plan, and how it's reflected in the plan document. And we'll actually start to go into some of the cost containment programs and ideas that are out there that will make your plan attractive to these low-risk lives. And all of the maneuvers you need to make with your plan document to ensure that you do it in a compliant fashion, that you implement appropriately, and that you make the creation and drafting of these plan documents as smooth and as easy and as flawless as possible. Because adding all these new programs and services to make your plan attractive sounds like a lot of work. We're trying to figure out ways to make it as easy as possible for everybody. So with that, I sign off today. Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone who sent me birthday wishes on LinkedIn. Appreciate it. For Brady, Jen McCormick, the absent Adam Russo, the entire team, and myself, thank you so, so very much. Again, there is a link to register for the webinar here and on our website. Please be sure to visit and sign up, and we'll see you then. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a good one.